The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 2, Side 2.
The warders also perfected the practice of trapping four fingers in the handcuffs, which caused acute pain in the finger joints. In Berlag, the handcuffs were used religiously. For every trifle, even for failure to take off your cap to a warder, they put on the handcuffs, hands behind the back, and stood you by the guardhouse. The hands became swollen and numb, and grown men wept. "I won't do it again, sir. Please take the cuffs off." Wondrous were the ways of Berlag. Not only did prisoners enter the mess hall on command, they lined up at the tables on command, sat down on command, lowered their spoons into the gruel on command, rose and left the room on command. It was easy enough for someone to scribble the order, establish special camps, submit draft regulations by such and such a date. But somewhere, hard-working penologists and psychologists and connoisseurs of camp life had to think out the details. How could screws already galling be made yet tighter? How could burdens already back-breaking be made yet heavier? How could the lives of gulags, denizens, already far from easy, be made harder yet? Transferred from corrective labor camps to special camps, these animals must be aware at once of their strictness and harshness. But obviously someone must first devise a detailed program. Naturally, the security measures were strengthened. In all special camps, the perimeter was reinforced. Additional strands of barbed wire were strung up, and coils of barbed wire were scattered about the camp's fringe area. On the path by which prisoners went to work, machine guns were set up in readiness at all main crossroads and turnings, and gunners crouched behind them. Every camp division had its stone jailhouse, its disciplinary barracks, BUR. I shall continue to call it by this name, which prisoners remembered from the corrective labor camps and went on using out of habit, although it is not quite accurate in this context. It was the camp jail, neither more nor less. Anyone put in the disciplinary barracks invariably had his padded jacket taken from him. Torture by cold was an important feature of the BUR. But every hut was just as much a jail, since all windows were barred and latrine buckets were brought in for the night so that all doors could be locked. Moreover, there were one or two disciplinary barracks in each camp area with intensified security, each a separate camplet within the camp. These were locked as soon as the prisoners got in from work, on the model of the earlier katorga. They were BURs, really, but we called them rezhimki. Then again, they quite blatantly borrowed from the Nazis, a practice which had proved valuable to them, the substitution of a number for the prisoner's name, his human individuality, so that the difference between one man and another was a digit more or less in an otherwise identical row of figures. This measure, too, could be a great hardship, provided it was implemented consistently and fully. This they tried to do. Every new recruit, when he played the piano in the special section, that is, had his fingerprints taken, as was the practice in ordinary prisons, but not in corrective labor camps, had to hang around his neck a board suspended from a rope. His number, SHCH262, will do as an example, was set up on the board. In Oetzerlag, by now, there were even numbers beginning with YERY. The alphabet was too short. And in this guise, he had his picture taken by the special section's photographer. All those photographs are still preserved somewhere. One of these days we shall see them. They took the board from around the prisoner's neck, he wasn't a dog after all, and gave him instead four, or in some camps three, white patches measuring 8 centimeters by 15. These he had to sew onto his clothes, usually on the back, the breast, above the peak of his cap, and on one leg or arm. But the regulations varied slightly from camp to camp. Quilted clothing was deliberately damaged in stipulated places before the patches were sewn on. In the camp workshops, a separate team of tailors was detailed to damage new clothing. Squares of fabric were cut out to expose the wadding underneath. This was done so that prisoners trying to escape could not unpick their number patches and pass as free workmen. In some other camps, it was simpler still. The number was burned into the garments with bleaching fluid. Warders were ordered to address prisoners by their numbers only and to ignore and forget their names. It would have been pretty unpleasant if they had kept it up, but they couldn't. Russians aren't Germans. Even in the first year, warders occasionally slipped up and called people by their names, and as time went by, they did it more often. To make things easier for the warders, a plywood shingle was nailed onto each bunk at every level, with the occupant's number on it. Thus, the warder could call out the sleeper's number even when he could not see it on his garments. And if a man was missing, the warder would know at once who was breaking the rules. Another useful field of activity opened up for warders. They could quietly turn the key in the lock and tiptoe into the hut before getting up time to take the numbers of those who had risen too soon. Or they could burst into the hut exactly on time and take the numbers of those who were not yet up. In both cases, you could be summarily awarded a spell in the hole, but in the special camp it was usually thought better to demand a written explanation, although pens and inks were forbidden and no paper was supplied. This tedious, long-winded offensive procedure was rather a clever invention, especially as the camp administration had plenty of salaried idlers with leisure to scrutinize the explanations. Instead of simply punishing you out of hand, they required you to explain in writing why your bed was untidy, why the number plate at your bunk was askew, and why you had done nothing about it, why a number patch on your jacket was soiled, and why you had not put that right, why a cigarette had been found on you in the hut, why you had not taken your cap off to a warder. Doroshevich was surprised to find prisoners taking their caps off to the prison governors on Sakhalin, but we had to uncover whenever we met an ordinary warder. Questions so profound that writing answers to them was even more of a torment to the literate than to the illiterate. But refusal to write meant that your punishment would be more severe. The note was written, with the neatness and precision which respect for the disciplinary staff demanded, delivered to the warder in charge of the hut, then examined by the assistant disciplinary officer or the disciplinary officer who in turn wrote on it his decisions about punishment. In work rolls, too, it was the rule to write numbers before names. Why before, and not instead of names? They were afraid to give up names altogether. However you look at it, a name is a reliable handle, a man is pegged to his name forever, whereas a number is blown away at a puff. If only the numbers were branded or picked out on the man himself, that would be something. But they never got around to it. Though they might easily have done so, they came close enough. The oppressive number system tended to break down for yet another reason, because we were not in solitary confinement, because we heard each other's voices and not just those of the warders. The prisoners themselves not only did not use each other's numbers, they did not even notice them. How, you may wonder, could anyone fail to notice those glaring white patches on a black background? When a lot of us were assembled, on work line-up or for inspection, the bewildering array of figures gave you spots before your eyes. It was like staring at a logarithm table, but only while it was new to you. So little did you notice them that you did not even know the numbers of your closest friends and teammates. Your own was the only one you remembered. Some dandified trustees carefully saw to it that their numbers were neatly, even jauntily, sewn on, with the edges tucked in, with minute stitching, to make them really pretty. Lackeys born and bred. My friends and I, on the contrary, took care that our numbers should look as ugly as possible. The special camp regime assumed a total lack of publicity, assumed that no one would ever complain, no one would ever be released, no one would ever break out. Neither Auschwitz nor Katyn had taught our bosses anything. And so the first special camps were special camps with truncheons. It was, as a rule, not the warders who carried them, they had the handcuffs, but trusted prisoners, hut orderlies and foremen. They, however, could beat us to their heart's content with the full approval of authority. At Jez Kazgan, before work line-up, the workers' signers stood by the doors of the huts with clubs and shouted, "Out you come, and no last man!" The reader will have understood that if there should be a last man, it was immediately as though he had never been. In Spassk in 1949, something snapped. The foremen were called to the staff hut, ordered to put away their clubs, and advised to do without them in future. For the same reason, the authorities were not greatly upset if, for instance, a winter transport from Karbas to Spassk, 200 men, froze on the way, if all the wards and corridors of the medical section were packed with the survivors, rotting alive with a sickening stench, and Dr. Kolesnikov amputated dozens of arms, legs, and noses. This Dr. Kolesnikov was one of the experts who had shortly before signed the mendacious findings of the Katyn Commission, to the effect that it was not we who had murdered the Polish officers. For this, a just providence had put him in this camp. But why did the powers of this world want him there, so that he would not talk too much? Othello's occupations gone. The wall of silence was so reliable that the celebrated disciplinary officer at Spassk, Captain Vorobyov, and his underlings first punished an imprisoned Hungarian ballerina by putting her in the black hole, then handcuffed her, then, while she was handcuffed, raped her. The disciplinary regime envisaged patient attention to every detail. Thus, prisoners were not allowed to keep photographs, either of themselves, which might help escapers, or of their relatives. Should any be found, they were confiscated and destroyed. A barracks representative in the women's division at Spassk, an elderly schoolteacher, put a small picture of Tchaikovsky on a table. The warder removed it and gave her 3 days in the black hole. "But it's a picture of Tchaikovsky." "I don't care whose picture it is. In this camp, women aren't allowed to have pictures of men." In Kengir, prisoners were allowed to receive meal in their food parcels. Why not? But there was a rigorous prohibition against boiling it, and if a prisoner managed to make a fire between a couple of bricks, the warder would kick over the pot and make the culprit smother the flames with his hands. Later on, it is true, they built a little shed for cooking, but 2 months later the stove was demolished and the place was used to accommodate some pigs belonging to the officers and security officer Belyaev's horse. While they were introducing various disciplinary novelties, our masters did not forget what was best in the practice of the corrective labor camps. In Odzelag, Captain Mishin, head of a camp division, tied recalcitrants behind a sleigh and towed them to work. By and large, the regime proved so satisfactory that prisoners from the former political camps, Katorga, were now kept in the special camps on the same footing as the rest and in the same quarters, distinguished only by the serial letters on their number patches. Though, if there was a shortage of huts, as at Spassk, it was they who would be put to live in barns and stables. So that the special camp, though not officially called Katorga, was its legitimate successor and merged with it. For a prison regime to have a satisfactory effect on the prisoners, it must be grounded also on sound rules about work and diet. The work chosen for the special camps was always the hardest in the locality. As Chekhov has truly remarked, the established view of society, and with some qualifications of literature, is that no harder and more degrading form of hard labour can be found than that in the mines. If in Nekrasov's Russian Women the hero's job had been to catch fish for the jail or to fell trees, many readers would have felt unsatisfied. Why speak so disparagingly of tree-felling, Anton Pavlovich? Lumbering is not so bad. It will do the trick. The first divisions of Steplag, those it began with, were all engaged in copper mining. The first and second divisions at Rudnik, the third at Kengir, and the fourth at Jezkazgan. They drilled dry, and the dust from the waste rock quickly brought on silicosis and tuberculosis. Under a law of 1886, no form of work which might be injurious to health was permitted, even if it was the prisoner's own choice. Sick prisoners were sent to die in the celebrated Spassk camp near Karaganda, the all-union convalescent home of the special camps. Spassk deserves a special mention here. It was to Spassk that they sent terminal cases for whom other camps could no longer find any use. But what a surprise! No sooner did the sick cross the salubrious boundary lines of Spassk than they turned into able-bodied workers. For Colonel Chechev, commandant of the whole Steplag complex, the Spassk camp division was one of his special favorites. The thick-set thug would fly in from Karaganda, have his boots cleaned in the guardhouse, and walk through the camp trying to spot prisoners not working. He liked to say, "I've only got one invalid in the whole Spassk camp. He's short of both legs. And even he's on light duties. He runs errands. All one-legged men were employed on sedentary work, breaking stones for road servicing or grading firewood. Neither crutches nor even a missing arm was any obstacle to work in Spassk. One of Chechev's ideas, putting four one-armed men to carry a stretcher. Two of them left-armed, two of them right-armed. An idea thought up for Chechev, driving the machines in the engineering shop by hand when there was no electric power. Something Chechev liked, having his own professor. So he allowed the biophysicist Chezhivsky to set up a laboratory at Spassk with empty benches. But when Chezhivsky, using worthless waste materials, devised an anti-silicosis mask for the Jezkazgan workers, Chechev would not put it into production. They've always worked without masks. Why complicate things? After all, there must be a regular turnover to make room for the new intake. At the end of 1948, there were about 15,000 prisoners, male and female, in Spassk. It was a huge camp area. The posts of the boundary fence went uphill in some places, and the corner watchtowers were out of sight of each other. The work of self-segregation gradually proceeded. The prisoners built inner walls to separate women, workers, complete invalids. This would hinder communications within the camp and make things easier for the bosses. 6,000 men building a dike had to walk 12 kilometers to work. Since they were sick men, it took them more than 2 hours each way. To this must be added an 11-hour working day. It was rare for anyone to last 2 months on that job. The job next in importance was in the stone quarries, which were inside the camp itself, both in the men's and in the women's section. The island had its own minerals. In the men's section, the quarry was on a hillside. The stone was blasted loose with ammonal after the day's work was over, and next day the sick men broke the lumps up with hammers. In the women's zone, they didn't use ammonal. Instead, the women dug down to the rock layers with picks, then smashed the stone with sledgehammers. The hammerheads, of course, came away from the handles, and new ones sometimes broke. To replace a head, a hammer had to be sent to a different camp zone. Nonetheless, every woman had an output norm of 0.9 cubic meters a day, and since they could not meet it, there was a long period during which they were put on short rations, 400 grams, until the men taught them to pinch stone from old piles before the daily accounting. Remember that all this work was done not only by sick people, not only without any mechanical aids at all, but in the harsh winter of the steppes, at temperatures as low as 30 to 35 degrees below freezing and with a wind blowing. And what is more, in summer clothing, since there was no provision for the issue of warm clothing to non-workers, that is, to the unfit. P. Blank R. recalls how she wielded a huge hammer, practically naked, in frosts as severe as this. The value of this work to the fatherland becomes very clear when we add that for some reason the stone from the women's quarry proved unsuitable as building material, and on a certain day a certain high official gave instructions that the women should dump all the stone they had quarried in a year back where it came from, cover it with soil, and lay out a park. They never, of course, got quite that far. In the men's zone the stone was good. The procedure for delivering it to the construction site was as follows. After inspection, the whole workforce, around 8,000 men, all those who were alive on that particular day, was marched up the hill, and no one was allowed down again unless he was carrying stone. On holidays, patients took their constitutional twice daily, morning and evening. Then came such jobs as self-enclosure, building quarters for the camp administration and the guards, dwelling houses, a club, a bathhouse, a school, and work in the fields and gardens. The produce from these gardens also went to the free personnel, while the prisoners got only beet tops. This stuff was brought in by the truckload and dumped near the kitchens, where it rotted until the cooks pitchforked it into their cauldrons. A bit like feeding cattle, would you say? The eternal broth was made from these beet tops with a daily addition of one ladleful of mush. Here is a horticultural idyll from Spassk. About 150 prisoners made a concerted rush at one of the garden plots, lay on the ground, and gnawed vegetables pulled from the beds. The guards swarmed around, beating them with sticks. but they just lay there, munching. Non-working invalids were given 550 grams of bread, working invalids 650. Medicines were as yet unknown in Spassk. Where would you find enough for a mob like that? And they were there to peg out anyway. And so were proper beds. In some huts, bunks were moved up together, and four men instead of two squeezed onto a double bed platform. Oh, yes, there is one job I haven't yet mentioned. Every day, 110 to 120 men went out to dig graves. Two Studebakers carried the corpses in slatted boxes, with their legs and arms sticking out. Even in the halcyon summer months of 1949, 60 or 70 people died every day, and in winter it was 100. The Estonians who worked in the morgue kept the count. In other special camps, mortality was not so high. Prisoners were better fed, but their work was harder too, since they were not unfit. The reader can make the necessary adjustment himself. All this was in 1949, the year 1949, the 32nd year after the October Revolution, 4 years after the war, with its harsh imperatives, had ended, 3 years after the conclusion of the Nuremberg trials, where mankind at large had learned about the horrors of the Nazi camps, and said with a sigh of relief, "It can never happen again." Add to all this that on transfer to a special camp, your links with the outside world, with the wife who waited for you and for your letters, with the children for whom you were becoming a mythical figure, were as good as severed. 2 letters a year, but even these were not posted after you had put into them thoughts saved up for months. Who would venture to check the work of the women censors on the MGB staff? They often made their task lighter by burning some of the letters they were supposed to censor. If your letter did not get through, the post office could always be blamed. In Spassk, some prisoners were once called in to repair a stove in the censor's office, and they found there hundreds of unposted letters, which the censors had forgotten to burn. Conditions in the special camps were such that the stove menders were afraid to tell their friends. The state security boys might make short work of them. These women censors in the Ministry of State Security who burned the souls of prisoners to save themselves a little trouble, were they any more humane than the SS women who collected the skin and hair of murdered people? As for family visits, they were unthinkable. The address of every special camp was classified, and no outsider was allowed to go there. Let us also add that the Hemingway-esque question, to have or to have not, hardly arose in the special camps, since it had been firmly resolved from the day of their creation in favour of not having money and receiving no wages. In corrective labour camps it was still possible to earn a pittance, but here not a single kopeck, not having a change of shoes or clothing, nor anything to put on underneath to keep yourself warm or dry. Underwear, and what underwear? Hemingway's pauper would hardly have deigned to put it on, was changed twice a month, other clothes and shoes twice a year. It was all laid down with a crystalline clarity worthy of Arakchev. Not in the first days of the camp, but later on they fitted out a permanent storeroom where clothes were kept until the day of release, and not handing in any article of wear among your personal belongings was considered a serious offence. It counted as preparation to escape, and meant the black hole and interrogation. Not to keep food in your locker. You queued in the evening to hand it in at the food store, and in the morning to draw it out again, which effectively occupied those half hours in the morning and evening when you might have had time to think. Not to have anything in manuscript, not to have ink, indelible pencils, or coloured pencils, not to have unused paper, in excess of one school notebook. And finally, not to have books. In Spassk, they took away books belonging to a prisoner on admission. In our camp, we were allowed to keep one or two at first, but one day a wise decree was issued. All books belonging to prisoners must be registered with the Culture and Education section, where the words Steplag, Camp Division, Number, would be stamped on the title page. Henceforward, all unstamped books would be confiscated as illegal, while stamped books would be considered the property of the library, not that of their former owners. Let us further remind ourselves that in special camps, searches were more frequent and intensive than in corrective labor camps. Prisoners were carefully searched each day as they left for and returned from work. Huts were searched regularly, floors raised, fire bars levered out of stoves, boards pried up in porches. Then there were prison-type personal searches, in which prisoners were stripped and probed, linings ripped away from clothes and soles from shoes. That after a while they started weeding out every last blade of grass in the camp area in case somebody hides a weapon there. That 3 days were taken up by chores about the camp. If you remember all this, it may not surprise you to hear that making him wear numbers was not the most hurtful and effective way of damaging a prisoner's self-respect. When Ivan Denisovich said, "They weigh nothing, the numbers," it does not mean that he has lost all self-respect, as some haughty critics who never themselves wore numbers or went hungry have disapprovingly said. It is just common sense. The numbers were vexatious, not because of their psychological or moral effects, as the bosses intended, but for a purely practical reason, that on pain of a spell in the hole we had to waste our leisure hours sewing up hems that had come unstitched, getting the figures touched up by the artists, or searching for fresh rags to replace patches torn at work. The people for whom the numbers were indeed the most diabolical of the camp's devices were the devout women members of certain religious sects. There were some of these in the women's camp division near the Suzlovo station, Kamishlag. About a third of the women there were imprisoned for their religion. Now it is plainly foretold in the book of Revelations, chapter 13, verse 16, that it causes all to be marked on the right hand or the forehead. These women refused, therefore, to wear numbers, the mark of Satan, nor would they give signed receipts, to Satan, of course, in return for regulation dress. The camp authorities, Chief of Administration General Grigoriev, head of separate camp site Major Bogush, showed laudable firmness. They gave orders that the women should be stripped to their shifts and have their shoes taken from them. The job went to wardresses who were members of the Komsomol, thus enlisting Winter's help in forcing these senseless fanatics to accept regulation dress and so on their numbers. But even with the temperature below freezing, the women walked about the camp in their shifts and barefoot, refusing to surrender their souls to Satan. Faced with this spirit, the spirit of reaction, needless to say, enlightened people like ourselves would never protest so strongly about such a thing. The administration capitulated and gave their clothing back to the sectarians, who put it on without numbers. Yelena Ivanovna Usova wore hers for the whole 10 years. Her outer garments and underwear rotted and fell to pieces on her body, but the accounts office could not authorize the issue of any government property without a receipt from her. Another annoying thing about the numbers was their size, which enabled the guards to read them from a long way off. They only ever saw us from a distance, at which they would have time to bring their guns to the ready and fire. They knew none of us, of course, by name, and since we were dressed identically, would have been unable to distinguish one from another but for our numbers. But now, if the guards noticed anybody talking on the march, or changing ranks, or not keeping his hands behind his back, or picking something up from the ground, the guard commander only had to report it to the camp, and the culprit would expect the black hole. The guards were yet another force which could crush a prisoner like a sparrow caught in a pulping machine. These red tabs, regular soldiers, these little lads with Tommy guns, were a dark, unreasoning force, knowing nothing of us, never accepting explanations. Nothing could get through from us to them, and from them to us came only angry shouts, the barking of dogs, the grating of breech blocks, bullets. And they, not we, were always right. In Ekibastutz, where they were adding gravel to a railroad bed, working without a boundary fence but cordoned by guards, a prisoner took a few steps inside the permitted area to get some bread from his coat, which he had thrown down. And one of the guards went for him and killed him. The guard, of course, was in the right. He would receive nothing but thanks. I'm sure he has no regrets to this day. Nor did we express our indignation. Needless to say, we wrote no letters about it. And if we had, our complaints would not have gone any further. On January the 19th, 1951, our column of 500 men had reached worksite ARM. On one side of us was the boundary fence with no soldiers between us and it. They were about to let us in through the gates. Suddenly, a prisoner called Malloy, Little, who was in fact a tall, broad-shouldered young man, broke ranks for no obvious reason and absent-mindedly walked toward the guard commander. We got the impression that he was not himself, that he did not know what he was doing. He did not raise his hand, he made no threatening gesture, he simply walked on, lost in thought. The officer in charge, a nasty-looking, foppish little fellow, took fright and started hastily backing away from Malloy, shouting shrilly, and try as he would, unable to draw his pistol. A sergeant Tommy Gunner advanced briskly on Malloy, and when he was within a few paces gave him a short burst in the chest and the belly, slowly backing away in his turn. Malloy slowly advanced another 2 paces before he fell, and tufts of wadding sprang into sight in the back of his jacket, marking the path of the invisible bullets. Although Malloy was down and the rest of the column had not stirred, the guard commander was so terrified that he rapped out an order to the soldiers, and there was a rattle of Tommy guns on all sides, raking the air just above our heads. A machine gun set up beforehand began chattering, and many voices vying with each other in hysterical shrillness screamed, "Lie down! Lie down! Lie down!" while the bullets came lower and lower to the level of the boundary wires. There were 500,000 of us, but we did not hurl ourselves on the men with the guns and trample on them. We prostrated ourselves and lay with our faces buried in the snow, in a humiliating and helpless position, lay like sheep for more than a quarter of an hour on that epiphany morning. They could easily have shot every last one of us without having to answer for it. Why, this was attempted mutiny. This was what we were like in the first and second years of the special camps. Pathetic, crushed slaves. But enough has been said about this period in Ivan Denisovich. How did it come about? Why did so many thousands of these misused creatures, the 58s, damn it all, they were political offenders, and now that they were separated, segregated, concentrated, surely they would behave like politicals. Why, then, did they behave so contemptibly, so submissively? These camps could not have begun differently. Both the oppressed and their oppressors had come from corrective labor camps, and both sides had decades of a master and slave tradition behind them. Their old way of life was transferred with them. They kept the old way of thinking alive and warm in each other's minds, because they traveled 100 or so at a time from the same camp division. They brought with them to their new place the firm belief inculcated in all of them that men are rats, that man eats man, and that it can be no other way. Each of them brought with him a concern for his own fate alone, and a total indifference to the fate of others. He came prepared to give no quarter in the struggle for a foreman's job, or a trustee's cozy spot in a warm kitchen, in the bread-cutting room, in the stores, in the accounts office, or in the culture and education section. When a man is being moved to a new place all by himself, he can base his hopes of getting fixed up there only on luck and his own unscrupulousness. But when men are transported together over great distances in the same boxcar for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, are kept stewing in the same transit prisons, are marched along in the same columns, they have plenty of time to put their heads together, to judge which of them has a foreman's fist, which knows how to crawl to the bosses, to play dirty tricks, to feather his nest at the expense of the working prisoners. And a close-knit family of trustees naturally does not indulge in dreams of freedom, but joins forces to uphold the cause of slavery, clubs together to seize the key posts in the new camp, and keep out trustees from elsewhere. While the benighted workers, completely reconciled to their harsh and hopeless lot, get together to form good work teams and find themselves a decent foreman in the new place. All these people had forgotten beyond recall not only that each of them was a man, that he carried the divine spark within him, that he was capable of higher things. They had forgotten, too, that they need not forever bend their backs, that freedom is as much man's right as air, that they were all so-called politicals, and that there were now no strangers in their midst. True, there were still a very few thieves among them. The authorities had despaired of deterring their favourites from frequent attempts to break out. Under Article 82 of the Criminal Code, the penalty was not more than 2 years, and the thieves had already collected decades and centuries of extra time, so why should they not run away if there was no one to dissuade them? And decided to pin charges under Article 58, Section 14, Economic Sabotage, on would-be escapers. Altogether, not very many thieves went into special camps, just a handful in each transport. But in their code there were enough of them to bully and insult people, to act as hut wardens, and walk around with sticks, like the two Azerbaijanis in Spassk, who were subsequently hacked to death. And to help the trustees plant on these new islands of the archipelago the flag, shit-coloured, trimmed with black, of the foul and slavish, destructive labour camps. The camp at Ekibastutz had been set up a year before our arrival, in 1949, and everything had settled down in the old pattern brought there in the minds of prisoners and masters. Every hut had a warden, a deputy warden, and senior prisoners, some of whom relied on their fists and others on tail-bearing to keep their subjects down. There was a separate hut for the trustees, where they took tea, reclining on their bunks, and amicably settled the fate of whole work sites and whole work teams. Thanks to the peculiar design of the Finnish huts, there were in each of them separate cabins occupied ex officio by one or two privileged prisoners. Worker signers rabbit-punched you, foremen smacked you in the kisser, warders laid on with the lash. The cooks were a mean and surly lot. All storerooms were taken over by freedom-loving Caucasians. Work assignment duties were monopolized by a clique of scoundrels who were all supposed to be engineers. Stool pigeons carried their tails to the security section punctually and with impunity. The camp, which had started a year ago in tents, now had a stone jailhouse, which, however, was only half-built and so always badly overcrowded. Prisoners sentenced to the hole had to wait in line for a month or even two. Law and order had broken down, no doubt about it, queuing for the hole. I was sentenced to the hole, and my turn never came. True, the thieves, or bitches to be more precise, since they were not too grand to take posts in the camp, had lost a little of their shine in the course of the year. They felt themselves somehow cramped. They had no rising generation behind them, no reinforcements in sight, no one eagerly tiptoeing after them. Things somehow weren't working out for them. Hut warder Magaran, when the disciplinary officer introduced him to the lined-up prisoners, did his best to glower at them defiantly, but self-doubt soon took possession of him, and his star sank ingloriously. We, like every party of new arrivals, were put under pressure while we were still taking our bath on admission. The bathhouse attendants, barbers and storemen were on edge, and ganged up to attack anyone who tried to make the most diffident complaint about torn underwear, or cold water, or the heat sterilization procedure. They were just waiting for such complaints. Several of them at once flew at the offender like a pack of dogs, yelling in unnaturally loud voices, "You aren't in the Kuibyshev transit prison now!" and shoving their ham-like fists under his nose. This was good psychology. A naked man is 10 times more vulnerable than one in clothes, and if newly arrived prisoners are given a bit of a fright before they emerge from the inaugural bath, they will begin camp life with their wings clipped. That same Volodya Gershuni, the student who had imagined himself taking a good look around in the camp and deciding whom to join, was detailed on his very first day to strengthen the camp by digging a hole for one of the poles to which lights were strung. He was too weak to complete his stint. Orderly Baturin, one of the bitches, who was beginning to sing smaller but still had a bit of bluster in him, called him a pirate and struck him in the face. Gershuni threw down his crowbar and walked right away from the hole. He went to the commandant's office and made a declaration. "You can put me in the black hole if you like, but I won't go to work as long as your pirates hit people." The word pirate had particularly upset him, because it was strange to him. His request was not refused, and he spent 2 consecutive spells in the black hole, 18 days in all. This is how it's done. A prisoner is given 5 or 10 days for a start, Then when his time is up, instead of letting him out, they wait for him to start protesting and cursing, whereupon they can legitimately stick him with a second spell. After the black hole, they awarded him a further 2 months of disciplinary barracks, which meant that he stayed on in the jailhouse, but would go out to work at the lime kilns and get hot food and rations according to his output. Realizing that he was sinking deeper and deeper into the mire, Gershuni sought salvation through the medical section. He hadn't yet taken the measure of Madame Dubinskaya, who was in charge of it. He assumed that he could just present his flat feet for inspection and be excused from the long walk to and from the lime kilns. But they wouldn't even take him to the medical section. The Ekebastutz disciplinary barracks had no use for the outpatient's clinic. Gershuni was determined to get there, and he had heard a lot about methods of protest. So one morning, when the prisoners were being lined up for work, he stayed on the bed platform, wearing only his underpants. Two warders, Polundra, a crack-brained ex-sailor, and Konentsov, dragged him off the bed platform by his feet and hauled him, just as he was, in his underpants to the lineup. As they dragged him, he clutched at stones lying on the ground, ready for the builders, and tried to hang on to them. By now he was willing to go to the lime kilns. "Just let me get my trousers on," he yelled. But they dragged him along just the same. At the guardhouse, while 4,000 men were kept waiting for their work assignments, this puny boy struggled as they tried to handcuff him, shouting, "Gestapo! Fascists!" Polundra and Konentsov, however, forced his head to the ground, put the handcuffs on, and prodded him forward. For some reason it was not they who were embarrassed, nor the disciplinary officer, Lieutenant Machakovsky, but Gershuni himself. How could he walk through the whole settlement in his underpants? He refused to do it. A snub-nosed dog handler was standing nearby. Volodya remembered how he muttered, "Stop making such a fuss. Fall in with the others. You can sit by the fire. You needn't work." And he held tightly onto his dog, which was struggling to break loose and get at Volodya's throat, because it could see that this lad was defying men with blue shoulder tabs. Volodya was removed from the work assignment area and taken back to the disciplinary barracks. The handcuffs cut more and more painfully into his wrists behind his back, and another warder, a Cossack, gripped him by the throat and winded him with his knee. Then they threw him on the floor. Somebody said in a business-like professional voice, "Thrash him till he umps himself." And they started kicking him with their jackboots about the temples and elsewhere until he lost consciousness. The next day he was summoned to the chief security officer, and they tried to pin a charge of terrorist intentions on him. When they were dragging him along, he had clutched at stones. Why? On another occasion, Tverdokhleb tried refusing to report for work assignment. He also went on a hunger strike. He was not going to work for Satan. Treating his declarations with contempt, they forcibly dragged him out. This took place in an ordinary hut, so that he was able to reach the window panes and break them. The jangle of breaking glass could be heard by the whole line-up, a dismal accompaniment to the voices of worker signers and warders counting. To the droning monotony of our days, weeks, months, years. And there was no ray of hope in sight. Rays of hope were not budgeted for in the MVD plan when these camps were set up. 25 of us newcomers, mostly Western Ukrainians, banded together in a work team and persuaded the worker signers to let us choose a foreman from our own number, Pavel Boronyuk, whom I have mentioned before. We made a well-behaved and hard-working team. The Western Ukrainians, farm workers only yesterday and not in collectives, needed no urging on. At times they had to be reined in. For some days we were regarded as general labourers, but then some of us turned out to be skilled bricklayers. Others started learning from them, and so we became a building brigade. Our bricklaying went well. The bosses noticed it, took us off the housing project, building homes for free personnel, and kept us in the camp area. They showed our foreman the pile of stones by the disciplinary barracks, the same stones which Gershuni had tried to hang on to, and promised uninterrupted deliveries from the quarry. They explained that the disciplinary barracks, as we saw it, was only half a disciplinary barracks, that the other half must now be built onto it, and that this would be done by our team. So, to our shame, we started building a prison for ourselves. This book is continued on cassette 3, side 1.